It's time for Security Now. We've got questions and answers. We've got security news. But we're going to kick things off with an interview with Joe Segrist. You may not know Joe, but you know his product. We talk about LastPass, the password vault, all the time. LastPass just sold to LogMeIn. We're going to talk to Joe Segrist, the co-founder and CEO of LastPass, and find out what's going on and can we still trust it? It's coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 529, recorded Tuesday, October 13th, 2015. Joe Segrist of LastPass. Security Now is brought to you by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code SecurityNow when you check out. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your privacy, your security online with this guy right here, Steve Gibson of GRC.com. He's our guru, our fearless leader. If Steve says it's good, it's good. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again, as always. We've got a bunch of stuff to talk about. We've got this is Patch Tuesday today, and Microsoft just about an hour ago dumped their updates for the month. There's some concern about a new problem that's been found an existing problem that sort of caught people by surprise in the SHA-1 hash that I saw the statistic just like during my research, but it was a large number of sites are still using it on the order of, I think it was like a quarter of websites today still using SHA-1. The press has, of course, gotten it wrong again, saying that it's broken, but it does take our breath away a little bit. But there's also news of the CAB forum that are the guys that manage certificate, you know, the whole certificate industry forum, essentially. They just put out, prior to this news, a ballot to consider extending the issuance of new SHA-1 signed certificates for one more year. So we'll talk about that. And, of course, this is a Q&A episode, so we've also got 10 questions and comments from our listeners that we'll go through and discuss. But the big news of the week, the Twitter feed filling event for me was the news that LastPass was being acquired or had been acquired or was in some state of acquisition by LogMeIn. And I thought, you know, there was like a ton of reaction on LastPass's site from users and lots of people saying, oh, my God, you know, is this the end of the world? What does this mean? And I thought, who better to help us understand this than the founder and CEO of LastPass himself, Joe? So he's our guest for a little conversation here at the top of the podcast.
That's exciting. And LastPass, of course, is the password vault program that you vetted and picked among all the rest, and I've been recommending for years and using for years. In fact, I just checked, and I have more than 400 passwords in my LastPass vault, and we use it here at Twit. It's our enterprise solution as well. We use LastPass Enterprise. So, as any time a company gets sold, there's a lot of concern. I think we should just jump to Joe right now. And
yeah, I was going to say that by way of introduction, the reason I am as comfortable and have been as confident of LastPass as I have been is Joe was absolutely forthcoming with, and our listeners who have been following the podcast for a while know this, if I can't get documentation, if I can't get someone to explain to me what they've done, then I can't understand it. So, for example, famously, you know, BitTorrent Sync came out and they refused to share the protocol. So people say, what do you think of BitTorrent Sync, Steve? And I say, I don't know. There's no way to know what it's doing. It's a black box. But from the very start, Joe's entire posture, his whole approach was, here's what we're doing if you're interested. And even to go as far as to create a page that had, I'll never forget this, code which was able to decrypt the LastPass vault in the same way that they were doing it, where the code was very legible and obvious in how it worked. So we were able to essentially sort of do a self-audit to verify that, this is how the thing worked. And so from my standpoint, where I started at the beginning was it was purely that the tech that I was able to say that this was done right. The technology is solid. And then, of course, it has succeeded because it's been made cross-platform. It's over on mobile devices. It's got the features everybody wants, and so those are not about the technology, but those are all certainly part of what made it a success. But from our standpoint, it was, I could say, I understand what this is doing. I can't see how it could be done better. So this is what I'm using.
Yeah.
And so of course, the basis of understanding of what it does and how it works is what for us drove our choice.
Absolutely. And the openness of the CEO and founder who's joining us right now, Joe Sechrist. First of all, I guess congratulations are in order, Joe.
Thank you.
And the sale hasn't gone through yet, has it?
So we signed an agreement, but no, it has not closed yet.
Okay. When do you anticipate that's going to happen?
I'm hoping late this week, but it's not, anything can change that. There's a lot of paperwork that has to be done, as you might imagine.
Sure.
It is the case that if you look at the logmein.com site under products, LastPass is now listed there. It's a link that takes you over to LastPass.com. So there's no, integration into them yet. But so I guess my first question, Joe, is are you at all taken aback by or surprised by the user base reaction to the news? Did you expect something like this?
I expected some people to be concerned. I didn't quite expect how vocal some of the minority would be, like how much they cared. I think we had questions ourselves when we went up there, and I felt like I understood everything that had happened at LogMeIn, was very comfortable with it. And they've been very open and forthcoming with me about, how much they want to leave to me to keep running the business and keep driving the product forward and keeping the security model the same. I think all those things, gave me a lot of comfort that this would be, a great home where we could have more resources essentially to keep pushing the product forward.
So I guess one question is, to the degree that you can share it without divulging any trade secrets, can you give us some sense for LastPass's future?
It's the same future that we were on. It's just an accelerator. More resources, more development resources, more QA resources, additional products that LogMeIn had been working on themselves, that we can fold in under the LastPass brand. But LastPass is the brand. LastPass is the product that they are betting on and what's going to be the future moving forward.
What is Meldium?
Meldium is kind of a team-based password sharing program. It has a different technological foundation than LastPass. It has a lot of features that we might pull in ultimately into LastPass, but certainly has a kind of a different use case and different foundation of how it works. That's really been based around kind of teams sharing passwords, kind of differently than the zero trust, zero knowledge model that LastPass has worked on.
So, I guess what has everyone concerned is that they, as a consequence of some of LogMeIn's history, they've not been happy with their experience with LogMeIn. And so the idea that there's any contamination of LastPass by LogMeIn, as you and I corresponded briefly before this, I was explaining that from my own take on watching what people are saying, we know that the trust in our password manager is difficult to come by. You've earned it over the years, like both with the original design and the way that LastPass has conducted itself. When you have had some security concerns, you've been absolutely forthright and forthcoming. You've explained what's going on. Thanks to the technology, we've been safe from any exploitation. If somebody did get loose in your network, the amount of damage they could potentially do has been minimized. So everyone until Friday was feeling really good about this, and suddenly it's like, I guess I would argue that it would be impossible for change to be good because what we already have is perfect. So, it's like if your car is running fine and something changes, well, it's probably not for the better. So what do you think?
Well, I understand that people, fear change, honestly. And, change is a reality, though. We have to deal with it ourselves here at LastPass, too. Like, every app is changing. The landscape is changing. How identity is evolving is changing. And, when we look around and try to understand where to take this forward, certainly having more resources was a key to being able to kind of dominate the space. And that's what we want to do. We want to keep making the product better, and we want to increase the amount of people working on this, increase the amount of resources that we have to make the product better. And I know people are kind of fearing that something is fundamentally going to change, but I'm here to say that that's not going to happen. I'm here to continue working on this, to keep, pushing forward the vision that I've been working on for the last 7.5 years. I'm not just going to, allow that to change. I really want to keep pushing it forward, and I really saw this as kind of the next step. I was, I think, a lot of the people that are complaining are very vocal because, something that they had for free was taken away, and people don't like that.
I'm going to disagree with you, Joe. That's not the issue.
Oh, yeah?
The issue is LogMeIn, and I think a lot of people burned by LogMeIn in the past, by what LogMeIn did to Hamachi, what they did to their free product. I think there's a real feeling that LogMeIn is not going to be a good custodian of the great legacy that you've created with LastPass. Have they given you any assurances that you'll have autonomy and you'll be able to continue to operate as you have in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. They've, just today, the incoming CEO, Bill Wagner, was here telling me that, look, you have the ability to say no. It's your vision. It's your team. We're putting resources behind that to drive it forward. And this is the largest acquisition by LogMeIn by more than 6 times, right? So they are going to naturally have to treat this, differently than some of those other products. And Hamachi is an interesting thing that you brought up, because I was talking about that today as a product I used to use and one that I think should be brought back and could really, have a new life breathed into it when you consider you can tie it into some of the other initiatives that we have with identity and have it, folded in potentially, as an additional product. But I think just the size and scale and scope makes that different. And, and the people behind it, like this office is staying, all the people here are staying, everybody that was part of LastPass is coming on board.
You understand why it's a more serious concern, because we're trusting you, and I trust you, Joe Segrist, with our with our credentials. But if there's a lack of trust for the acquiring company, that raises a cause for concern. And Frank, let's be frank, this is a very competitive space. There are more than a dozen other products that do something similar. I've tried them all. None of them are as good as LastPass. But you can see why, there's cause for concern. There was a rumor that you have a bonus for customer acquisition. Is that true? Or customer retainment, I'm sorry. Is that true?
I mean, there's a bonus based on our performance and, from a bookings perspective that we keep, selling to customers. So I think that's pretty natural in a deal this size that, they want to incentivize the team to keep pushing and growing the product and the business. So, yes, there is one that should not be seen as a bad thing from my point of view. I mean, it means that everybody here is still trying to make the product better, trying to make sure that everybody realizes that, it's the same people behind it. They're going to be doing the same thing that they've always done for you. It's just they're going to have more resources when they do it. I look at all of this and say, like, look, we have a great opportunity here to actually go faster and do more. And because it's the same people running it, I'm still going to be in charge of LastPass. I'm still making the decisions. I've been told explicitly not to do anything that I wouldn't do or would make me uncomfortable. I think a lot of that goes a long way to, at least giving us a shot to make sure that we can keep doing what we've always done for you, because I have earned that trust. I would like to think that, and I hope I can keep it by essentially continuing to do the exact same thing that I've always done and keep acting in the same way, putting customers first, making sure security is first, and driving the product forward in the same way that we always have here. You have the exact same team working in the same place on the same product. It's just there's some more resources to make things move a little faster. I think it's going to be a good thing for users, despite the reluctance and the fear by a lot of people.
I think it would go a long way to me and a lot of other users if to hear from you that kind of commitment that you're going to stand up for us, and as long as your name continues to be on that product, that we can trust that it's the same integrity, the same product that we've used for all these years.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I was just going to interject in terms of what Joe was saying he wanted to do. I would say also maintaining the kind of openness and transparency that we've seen before is crucial. And it's been one of the things that has earned the trust, is everyone has had a sense of like, okay, LastPass is not hiding anything from us. And so, for example, it's great that you're spending some time with us today to sort of help us understand what has happened.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate you guys having me on. I appreciate all the support you've given me over the years. Like, Steve, honestly, I couldn't get people to understand what we were doing in the early days. People just thought, oh, Cloud Password Manager, worst idea I've ever heard of, until you actually looked into it and understood it, and then we really started moving forward. You were pretty integral to kind of the path that we got to here. And, I guess I'm, here saying that, look, nothing's really changed from my point of view, other than I have more resources, and I'm going to keep acting how I've always acted, in the best interest of customers, in the best interest of the product, and how it should be run. Because I have very strong feelings, having built this thing over the last 7.5 years, of how it's supposed to be and how it should run, that is not easily changed.
Good. I think that, really that's what customers want to hear from you, Joe. They want to hear from you that you're committed to maintaining the integrity that you've had all along. And I think that goes a long way to keeping us happy customers.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you guys giving me the chance, and hopefully everybody else, you know, I mean, at worst, you know, wait and see, right? Like, you know, I think give me another chance to make sure that you see that we're going to keep doing what we've always done. And, you know, a year, 2 years down the line, you'll look back and say, why did we worry so much about
right.
this?
I hope so. Hey, who runs the servers? You or do they go into the LogMeIn cloud?
We're continuing to run the servers for now. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things ultimately we need to do is we have two servers kind of in the Northern Virginia area, and we need to kind of get more geographic diversity, two data centers, I should say, not two servers. You know, ultimately we'll change, but we're going to do that in the way that we've always done, which is be transparent about it, tell you about it, give you a lot of notice, and then ultimately do it, you know, after all of those things have happened and everyone has been notified, and, you know, it'll be done the right way.
Have you ever, excuse me, Steve, one more question. Have you ever considered, because what, and Steve and I were talking, and he kind of shocked me the last time we talked about this, which was right after the, I don't even want to use the word hack, right after the last thing that happened to you guys, which
network intrusion,
yeah. or presumed network intrusion, which
right.
I handled so very well, was that it can never be a trust no one solution as long as your passwords are stored somewhere else in such a way that somebody could get them, try to brute force them, that kind of thing. Have you ever considered a solution that would not involve storing the password vault on your servers, but maybe have your servers act as a transactional server, or maybe Wi-Fi syncing, or some other model in addition to what you do?
I really think Wi-Fi syncing and some other ways of syncing kind of just aren't the future, right? Like, it's just not the way people are going to do this moving forward. Now, a different technological solution that it still involves the cloud, perhaps, you know, multiple different trust parties, as things I've contemplated in the past. There's interesting ways you can solve this in a different way without, you know, fully going offline, right? And that you can solve the problem that you're concerned about, you know, in the same way. I mean, I think the fundamentals with LastPass mean that your data is safe so long as you use a strong password. If you use the software, you know, without, you know, logging in offline, you're like guaranteed that you are in a secure position. Can we improve on that? I think we can, but I don't think we need to go to the extreme of, like, you know, walking around USB thumb drives again. Like, I just think the future is everything's going to be connected and it's all going to be pervasive, and that, you know, any way where you just totally avoid the cloud is probably not the right long-term solution, that you can find better technological solutions that still involve the kind of ease of the cloud. And that's really more directional thing that I think we would be working on.
Right.
Good. Thank you.
Just your appearance here makes such a difference to me, and I know to a lot of your users. So I'm very grateful that you continue to maintain that openness, and I hope we'll always have these dialogues, because I think it's so valuable for us as users to see your face and to get the trust there, because we are trusting you with everything, Joe. You got it all. All my stuff. Thank you, Joe Segrist. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. For having you guys. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Joe Segrist, CEO and founder of LastPass. And I think it's fair to say, congratulations also, Joe.
Yeah. You've earned it.
Yeah. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for arranging that, Steve. You've been in touch with him in the past, you know, vetting this product. And I think it's great that you were able to do that.
And from time to time, when something's happened, I've shot him a note and said, okay, what what just happened? And so, you know, when he's able to tell me something, he's always been available and forthcoming. I was, you know, curious to see if I shot him an email yesterday, would it disappear somewhere? And nope, he was right there. And he said, love to come on the show and talk to you guys. So, you know, as I said to you before we began recording, my sense is it's sort of a reaction like I had 16 months ago with TrueCrypt. You know, when one morning we woke up and discovered that the site had disappeared, and some people were immediately prone to say, "Oh my God, we have to immediately leave." And my feeling was, well, you know, it was fine yesterday. It's still the same code as today as it was then. So let's, you know, take a measured approach to this. And Joe essentially said what I hoped he would say. Maybe he said what he had to say. But I think it's also true. I get the sense from him that for today, nothing is going to change. And as you said, Leo, you've looked around at the alternatives. I have too. All of them are, you know, they fall short one way or another. I will say that one of the things I have always appreciated about LastPass is it is not doing anything to, like, impede your leaving. There is an off. Joe has an offline utility which is able to decrypt the database, so you can use it in sort of an offline mode. But if you go in your web browser where you've got LastPass installed under Tools Advanced, there's an export, and you can export your entire vault in a comma separated value CSV file. Which, you know, with a standard format where it labels the columns, and if you are really determined to, you can go somewhere else. But I see no reason to do that today.
Yeah, one of the problems I've had, and I've ever since this news been looking at alternatives, is it's not that I trust. There's no one else I trust either.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The only, you know, ClearPass is something that's much less convenient, which is an open source solution like KeePass, and where you have there's no trust needed. It is a true trust no one solution, but those are not nearly as convenient or as easy
yeah.
to use.
Yeah, and then you have the issue of it being maintained across multiple platforms.
Right.
I mean, the commercial side of LastPass is what has financed this. You know, the convenience that we all see. You know, and it's funny too, because, you know, Joe mentioned that this podcast played a big role in, you know, their early traction. And I was put in mind of Hamachi, which, of course, Hamachi Dave, as we used to call him, you know, we had him on the podcast. He may have been our very first guest on this show, because once again, I understood the technology. I loved what he had done. And he said himself that we put him on the map. Unfortunately, we put him on the map and logged me in, sucked him up. And so now we're two for two. I think maybe if we find something else that we really love, we just kind of have to whisper it a little bit more. And, you know, somehow keep it within the family. Within, you know, not have it go like big time, because then we, you know, log me in comes and sucks him up.
Well, I'm glad we got to talk to Joe. And
guess
for the time being, there's no reason to change for the time being because, you know, there's nowhere to go, really.
And
really is no reason not to trust so far.
I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I understand there will be people who just, this, you know, they don't like it. And it's like, well, okay, if listening to us, you know, you don't like it, then there are lots of alternatives. And I just pointed you toward the exit door, showing you how to create a comma-separated value file.
Right.
I don't think there's any reason to leave. I see no reason at all. And you know, for example, in the case of Hamachi, which is a sore point, because, of course, shortly after the acquisition, and I don't know any of the details about, like, what was going on behind the scenes, what was happening with Dave and or anything, but, of course, it just collapsed. It failed to be updated. All kinds of problems began occurring. And, I mean, again, I don't know anything about the background, but I think what we need to have is for something like our password manager, a zero tolerance policy. And Joe and company, his company, have never given us any reason to bolt, or we would have.
Right.
So I think until we're given a reason, this is the best, still the best password manager that is available. And again, if other people feel differently, I completely understand that, but I'm staying.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the problem is it's not change. It's log me in is really the problem. Had he sold it a trusted company that, you know, that might have been a different thing. But log me in's track record is just not great. I hope that they let him. I hope they understand the importance of the trust that he's built, and they let him continue to run the company autonomously, give him the resources he needs. As long as Joe is there, you know, that'll be to me the canary in the coal mine. If Joe disappears.
Yep.
Then I'm a move. But as long as Joe is there, I feel like, well, and that's why I asked him for that commitment. You know, you'll continue to maintain this integrity as long as you're there, right? And if you don't, if Log Me In says, no, guy, we're going to sell these addresses to the highest bidder, then you will leave and we will know. And I should have probably made that more explicit, but.
Well, you know, and you're right about Log Me In. I did a little poking around in the last couple of days because I was curious about this backlash. And for example, they once on their Facebook page in 2011 said, "We receive a lot of messages." This is Log Me In. This has nothing to do with LastPass. Log Me In. "We receive a lot of messages thanking us for making Log Me In free." Well. Log Me In free, because that was the name of the product. And they said, "Let's make this official. There's no need to thank us. Log Me In free is and will always be free. For today, you can just pay us in likes," they said. And then a couple of years later, on their blog on logmein.com, it was titled "Changes to Log Me In Free." And it reads, "After 10 years, Log Me In's free remote access product, Log Me In Free, is going away. We will be unifying our portfolio of free and premium remote access products into a single offering. This product will be a paid only offering." So it's like, okay, you know, they're on the record of not living up to their own commitments.
Right.
And so, you know, and even on MacBreak Weekly, when you were talking to Alex, you know, sort of like, I've had some bad experiences with them. So again,
I think that really is the source of all this upset.
Angst.
Yeah. And I think completely understandable. But I should also point out, I've been through acquisitions. There's always a honeymoon period. the companies always say, "Oh, we're not going to change a thing," until they do. So we just have to watch, right?
So I would say this has probably been good for Joe and company. That is, to witness this. I didn't verify, but some people said that they shut down posting to their blog announcement because there was so much negativity from their users. And yes, I completely get it that this is a vocal minority. This, however, are the opinion leading minority. You know, the people who know what this means and care, you know, we're the people that, you know, drive, you know, Jenny's using LastPass because that's, you know, and everybody I know is because that's the one. And so I think maybe it's been good for Joe to one step removed for Log Me In to understand that behavior really counts here. And, you know, as you said, Leo, there's lots of alternatives. I'm still happy here, but everybody is watching.
Yeah.
And so I think
you're right.
Again,
if he wasn't clear about that before, he is now, right?
Right.
Oh my God. But that's good in a way. I mean, it really shows people love LastPass and they really want to use it and they want to keep using it.
And as I in my notes and in a conversation with him, it is all about trust.
Yeah.
You know, we're this is our entire internet online experience. We're trusting to a third party. We're saying, we're saying encrypt this in a way that we believe you cannot, no aberrant employee can decrypt it. And put it in the cloud, and we're going to trust you with it. All of our website passwords.
Yeah.
So it was difficult to create that bond of trust in from the beginning, and it's fragile. It's brittle. So I think, both LastPass and LogMeIn need to understand that, we're here as long as things continue as they have been. But there's a zero tolerance policy on our end.
And if you keep listening to this show, I guarantee you, you'll hear if there's a problem. Yeah. Exactly. I'm going to set up KeePass, the open source solution, and just see how much harder it is. I know it'll be less convenient, but let's see how much harder it is. And of course, if you're carrying around a USB key with your password vault on it, that's maybe not such a good idea either. So...
yeah.
Let's take a break. I know you've got news. We've got Q&A. We've got a lot more to do. So
yep.
We're going to move on. Our show today brought to you by your razor, Steve Gibson's favorite razor.
It's Harry's. Or even my color. That's my color and handle.
It's his razor, folks. We went into his bathroom. We took a picture. We're talking about Harry's. Harry's is great. Harry's is a great shave at a fraction of the price. How do they do it? They bought the factory. They're selling factory direct to you, and it starts with the Harry's kit. I mean, you don't want to just go buy razors. You got to have a handle. Steve has the Truman, which is $15. I have the Winston. It's a little fancy. It's got a metal handle. You can get it engraved. But it's the same great blades. All of the kits, Winston or Truman, come with three blades, a handle, and the travel cover, which I find very useful, and then your choice of the foaming shave gel or the famous Harry's shave cream, which I still use because I'm an old-fashioned guy. But I think a lot of the new users are really fans of the foaming shave gel. Both of them smell fantastic and give you the best darn shave you've ever had. I want you to go right now to Harry's, HARRYS.com. Pick your kit to start with. The Truman or the Winston. And, they have daily face wash. I'm going to order that. Don't wash your face with soap, gentlemen. It's bad for you. Then once you get the kit, you can sign up for the regular delivery of blades. And you'll never have to think about it again. And you'll save, by the way, about half. Razor blades are very expensive. That's why they lock them up in the drugstore. We're talking about less than half of the Gillette Fusion price. Harry's, they make them in their own factory in Germany to their very high standards for sharpness and performance, and they ship them for free to your front door. And in each kit, you're going to get everything you need to get started. $25 for the Winston set, $15 for the Truman set. However, if you go to harrys.com right now and use the offer code SECURITYNOW, you'll get $5 off your first purchase. $10 for the Truman set. That's a great deal. Harry's.com. Use the offer code SECURITYNOW at checkout, and you'll be as good looking as Mr. Stephen Tiberius Gibson.
Well, let's hope we have a higher bar than that.
Harry's! All right, what's in the news?
At least you'll be clean shaven.
You'll be as clean shaven.
That's right. So, Patch Tuesday. And when I was putting things together this morning, there had been no update yet. So I left a little spider on their page. And I have to tell people, I've mentioned it before, but this thing works so well. And now I've forgotten what it's called. But if I right-click on this tab, it's called Check for Change with a numeral 4. Check numeral 4 change. It's a Firefox add-on. And when you're on any page, you highlight a region that you care about, and then you right-click on the tab, and then you tell it, check every minute, or maybe it's even every 30 seconds, every minute, every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, and so forth. And it automatically refreshes the page and sees whether that marked region has changed. And if it has, it plays an annoying audio file. Changes. And it's, you know, very short.
Plays Bowie? Oh, my God.
Anyway, so like when I'm waiting for the Apple Store to come back online and be the first person to purchase a new iSomething, or the other day I was waiting for it was to go see The Martian. I was waiting for the theater that I wanted to see it at to refresh their schedule, and I wanted to immediately nail the reserve seating that I wanted. And just this morning, on the Microsoft page, I marked the top of their table that showed September's updates, and then said check every minute. And the moment that page changed, I got, you know, changes, and it's like, oh, okay, good. And so now I'm able to tell our listeners. But anyway, check for change. It's just innocuous. It sits there, but anytime you like care about knowing when something changes, this does it. That's perfect. So we have 6 patch bundles, and they're split 3 critical and 3 important. There are 2 critical problems, which, and one of them is a little blood chilling. So this is high up on the list of update your Windows. The good news, though, is the blood-chilling one is only Vista and Windows Server 2008, nothing later. Presumably XP. I don't know that for sure. They don't tell us because, of course, that's unsupported and now. But what this is, the reason this is a little chilling is this is a remote code execution vulnerability in Microsoft's implementation of JavaScript and, or as they call it, JScript and VBScript, which of course is completely exposed to the internet. So we've been talking lately about attack surface, and this represents a frightening attack surface. You know, and my Microsoft said of this, you know, with the same sort of jargon we're used to from them, but there's some interesting stuff in here. This security update resolves vulnerabilities in the VBScript and JScript scripting engines in Microsoft Windows. The more severe of the vulnerabilities could allow remote code execution if an attacker hosts a specially crafted website that is designed to exploit the vulnerabilities through Internet Explorer. It says in parens, or leverages a compromised website or a website that accepts or hosts user-provided content or advertisements. So find one that doesn't. In other words, all websites. And then convinces a user to view the website. Now, yes, those of us with ad blockers, we're being protected because we're not receiving script in these ad blanks, which our browsers are then receiving. An attacker could also embed, Microsoft continues, an ActiveX control marked as safe for initialization in an application or Microsoft Office document that uses the IE rendering engine to direct the user to the specially crafted website. And then it goes on. But anyway, point is, there's a bad one here. It's not in the wild. It's not being exploited. But we now know that the way, the course this will take is that bad guys who see something as juicy as this is know that they've got some window of opportunity, especially if this goes back to XP, as I suspect it probably does. It looks like it got fixed in the jump to Windows 7 and Server 2008 R2 and subsequent. But probably this is XP. Those are not being patched any longer. And, you know, there's a dwindling population, but they're still around. Does need to have access to IE. So those would be, you know, people using up through IE8, I think is where it stops. But still, the point is they will examine the patch, reverse engineer what changed, and then figure out what was not known at the time of the patch. It will become known afterwards. And for something like this, this looks like it's an easy way into Windows machines. And Windows machines are not being kept patched. So you don't want to be one of those. Again, XP and Vista and Windows Server 2008 only, nothing subsequent. And of course, you know, those numbers are dwindling too. This podcast's chosen power user ad blocker got updated with the one feature that it needed. So I thank those guys for that. And that is this. So, of course, we're talking about One Blocker, which is the fancy one. They added the easy access site whitelisting so that when you're in Safari, you touch the little send the page somewhere arrow, whatever that's called, which pops up a list of things like that you can do with the page. And it's now possible. It was not turned on by default. So you'll have to go into the dot, dot, dot at the end of the far right hand end of the list. That opens up the drop down of switches. And then down at the bottom is it'll be switched off. So you probably want to turn it on and then use the little drag bars to drag it all the way to the top so that it then appears as your first choice. And I had some fun with it today. For example, I was on Google and after updating to 1.1, I whitelisted Google and then went into One Blocker. And the thing I like about it, the reason it's the power user's choice, is their under whitelisting was www.google.com with its own little switch. So this is the other ad blockers are preferred for just set it and forget it, simple, sort of users who don't want any extra features. And Purify is our choice there because it does have whitelisting and it is a sort of a set it or forget it. But for the typical Security Now listener, being able to, for example, browse your whitelisted apps and say, "Oh, why is that in there?" and I turn it off or remove it. You know, this gives us that kind of power. So I want to let people know that One Blocker version 1.1 is out and it's got easy whitelisting. And I did, in listening to MacBreak Weekly just before this, Leo, I heard Renee give a shout out to Tweetbot version 4, and I say, oh, thank God. Yes, I've been using it for a couple weeks. The Tweetbot for the iPhone had been kept kind of current, but the version for the pad had, they hadn't fixed it for years. And so things like the new free size DMing was not available. And there were just a whole bunch of other annoyances with it. And it's back. And I'm so pleased. Tweetbot is, my Twitter client for iOS. And I use TweetDeck in Firefox, on the desktop. I just think it's the right one. So there was some concern late toward the end of last week about so-called free start collisions, or what they're called, in the SHA-1 secure hash algorithm, which a large percentage of sites are still using. And, I'll say I'm there. I'm among them. GRC currently has my certs signed courtesy of DigiCert with SHA-1. But those certs expire on December 31st of this year. That's the only way to slice this so that Chrome is not punishing GRC and frightening its users, yet people who still need SHA-1, that is, who don't have clients which understand SHA-256, are still able to use GRC. I already have SHA-256 certs. Actually, DigiCert made both for me. They made midnight on New Year's Eve expiring SHA-1 certs, and I already have my regular ones. And so a day or two before the end of the year, I'll switch over. And so GRC will never be down, but I will have waited. I will have extended GRC's availability for down-spec clients to access my site securely, because the only way you can access it is securely. That was the point, is that you can't get to GRC anymore other than HTTPS. So I didn't want to cut people off prematurely, even though Chrome started scaring people about it. So years ago, Bruce Schneier predicted when based on the rate of increase in processing power and the level of difficulty that we know that SHA-1 hash has, when that the sort of the lines would cross, so that it would become technologically feasible for a nation state actor to put the screws on to SHA-1 with lots of processing power, and that is in terms of what it would cost, and be able to deliberately forge a signature. That's what this is all about. This all comes down to signature forging, because if somebody could forge a signature on an SHA-1 signed certificate, then that allows the certificate itself to be forged, because it's the signature that protects the certificate. So Bruce's guess, and this was I'm like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, was 2017 at the earliest, maybe 2018. Well, what's happened is that processing power, or the cost of processing power, has fallen, thanks largely to GPUs and ASICs. And a lot of this, of course, has been also driven by the Bitcoin phenomenon that, you know, no one could have predicted, that put a huge amount of resources behind increasing hashing performance. So researchers will be shortly releasing a paper where, for the first time, a non-reduced round SHA-1 compression function, which is not the whole SHA-1 hash, but it's the meat of SHA-1, the so-called compression function, a non-reduced round, they have been able to synthesize academically, a collision in that function using a 64 GPU cluster with 10 days of work. Now, this is not the same, and they acknowledge this, as a full SHA-1 collision, because that would require the entire hash function, and there's a lot of preamble and postamble work on each end on the incoming and outgoing of the compression function. But the meat of SHA-1 is this compression function. Previously, so-called reduced round collisions had been found. This is always the way it is. For example, even our beloved AES cipher, Rheindahl, it's been a while since I looked at it, but it's something like 13 rounds. And it's a little scary when you see them saying, well, an 8-round reduction is giving us compromised security. But this is all something that the designers understand, and they're trading off additional rounds which slow down processing versus brute force protection. The more rounds you have, the stronger it is, but at some point it's just stronger than you need, and so that's just wasted computational time. So that has all been set. In the case of SHA-1, this is a bit of a surprise. So again, this is not the whole hash. The hash, it's not like SHA-1 has been cracked or hacked or broken, or somebody found a magic key to it or anything. It's just that we really do have lots of processing power. The processing power is getting less expensive more quickly than we and than Bruce, 6 or 7 years ago anticipated. And so what that means is that we're moving this, the time at which it would become cost effective for somebody who really wished to pay for compute time or for hardware or whatever to create a spoof certificate. Now, people could argue, oh, the NSA's got all these resources and super crypto everything. It's like, yes, and they also probably have control over a handful of certificate authorities that all of our technology trusts implicitly. So they don't need to forge anything. You know, they could just make their own certificate, because there's no doubt that, you know, all of the major nation states have control over certificate authorities that are signing certificates that we trust. We have to assume that that's the case. So these are more other actors who it's suggested for a cost of $100,000 of computing cost could do something like this, although that still isn't allowing them to create a fraudulent certificate. That's, you know, anyway, so the point is, this argues that the sunsetting of SHA-1 in a timely fashion is an absolutely good thing. This is like this is another milestone along the path to its graveyard. But what's interesting is, but just before this announcement on Friday, two Fridays ago, I think what, October 3rd, some people at the so-called CAB forum, which is the industry's certificate authority association, they put forth for a two-week vote the proposal to continue issuing SHA-1 signed certs through 2016. As it is now, that is the signing of new SHA-1 certs is due to stop at midnight at the end of this year. So certs can continue to live into 2016, you know, although Chrome will frighten people, but they can. But the idea would be that no certificate authorities would issue any after midnight of New Year's at the end of 2015. So the following motion was proposed by Rick Andrews of Symantec, endorsed by Bruce Morton of Entrust, and Judy Coutier of Microsoft, and Kirk Hall of Trend Micro. So four major participants and players in the CA forum. So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs of this so you get a sense for why. So they said, the purpose of this ballot, which is and the voting ends in 3 days at the end of this week. So, and remember that this was floated before the news of this SHA-1 weakness sort of frightened the industry. They said, the purpose of this ballot is to allow the issuance of SHA-1 certificates through 2016 with maximum expiry date of 31 December 2016. So they're still talking about, so it would have a 1 year or less lifetime. Although the vast majority of customers have been able or will be able to transition to SHA-2 certificates, and remember that's like 256, because SHA-2 is actually a family of different size digest certs hashes, will be able to transition to SHA-2 certificates by the issuance termination date of 31 December 2015. That is the current termination. They say a very small number of very large enterprise customers have disclosed to us that they simply cannot complete this work before the issuance deadline. This is attributed to the sheer volume of certificates that they need to migrate, parens numbering in the thousands, close parens, and their end-of-year blackout period. I don't know what that is, maybe Christmas vacation. These customers accept the risk of continuing to use new SHA-1 certificates and assert if they can continue to and assert that if they can continue to enroll for and receive SHA-1 certificates through 2016, all with an expiration date of 31 December 2016 or earlier, they will be able to complete the transition by the end of 2016. So basically, a very small number of very large corporations are saying, we cannot be ready in time. Which must mean that they've got clients that cannot accept SHA-2 certs, and they can't fix those clients in time. So then the CAB forum says, we realize that extending the issuance period will extend the collision attack period, meaning this is the problem of certificate collisions, which is what we've been talking about. Although we feel that the BRs, as they call them, the baseline requirements, already mandate enough entropy, typically in the certificate's serial number, to guard against that attack. Now, of course, that we'll see how they feel now that this full non-reduced round collision has been created. They say it can be further mitigated by limiting SHA-1 certificate issuance to subordinate CAs that have a basic constraints path length of zero, meaning that those CAs are unable to issue them any further. So they said, just finishing, the intent of the ballot is to allow limited issuance of SHA-1 certificates through 2016, as long as any SHA-1 certificate created in 2016 expires by the end of 2016. We also correct the number, and blah, 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 it goes on. And this voting then ends this Friday. So I will keep an eye on this just because I'm curious, and we will see whether people decided, this seems like a bad idea. It does sound like, it's not clear whether these are public-facing servers or maybe internal. So they may be asking for non-public-facing certificates only for clients that of theirs that they are, for whatever reason, unable to upgrade in time so that they're able to connect to servers with SHA-2 certs, in which case, it wouldn't affect the broader public. Google and what Google does with the browser wouldn't matter. But I just thought this was interesting. A weird coincidence that here, as the deadline approaches, we have not only an improvement in another sort of proof of concept of, yes, folks, we really do need to get serious about moving away from SHA-1, and there being some entrenchment of why this is so hard to do. It's like the move from IPv4. It's like people have to be forced to make this change for their own good. And so it'll be interesting to see how this vote turns out. I did want to note that the Obama administration has opted for now not to force firms to decrypt data, which is to say the administration has decided that they will not request legislation making that a requirement. The New York Times, Nicole Perlroth and David Sanger broke this story, and I'll just share the beginning of it because it's succinct. They said, the Obama administration has backed down in its bitter dispute with Silicon Valley over the encryption of data on iPhones and other digital devices, concluding that it is not possible to give American law enforcement and intelligence agencies access to that information without also creating an opening that China, Russia, cyber criminals, and terrorists could exploit. With its decision, which angered the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, the administration essentially agreed with Apple, Google, Microsoft, and a group of the nation's top cryptographers and computer scientists that millions of Americans would be vulnerable to hacking if technology firms and smartphone manufacturers were required to provide the government with backdoors or access to their source code and encryption keys. So, boy, it was not only the right decision, but the correct understanding of the problem. So I say yay. And I made a note here. I said Security Now's take, our take is, and even if they did, that is, force backdoors and so forth, it wouldn't matter since strong and unbreakable encryption is already and always will be freely available because it's just math. It's loose. It's late. It's too late. Even if it were outlawed, bad guys will always be able to use it if they wish because it's just math. And, you know, you can't take it back. It's already out there. So it wouldn't have helped anyone who needed to stay cloaked, could have, even if the manufacturers were forced to create back doors, which, as we've often said, it's just no way to see how that can happen safely. So I went to privacytools.io, and I got a big kick out of the top of the page. Our listeners will remember privacytools.io was the site that I stumbled on thanks to somebody who tweeted to me about it, asking for what I thought. This great compendium of all things, like it's a recommendation site of privacy-related tools. And the huge on the page, top of the page, is, you know, their feelings about Windows 10, which I got a big kick out of. And, you know, listeners of this podcast can imagine what's there. But I saw something, a quote that just hit me between the eyes, that Edward Snowden posted on Reddit about 4 months ago. And I want to share his whole statement, from which one line is, like, I think, so, you know, like, just perfect. And this is regarding privacy. In my notes, I called it another way to look at privacy. You know, this is the whole I'm not overly concerned about privacy because I have nothing to hide approach. So he says, Snowden wrote, I think the central issue is to point out that regardless of the results, the ends, preventing a crime, do not justify the means. Violating the rights of the millions whose private records are unconstitutionally seized and analyzed. Some might say, wrote Snowden, I don't care if they violate my privacy. I've got nothing to hide. So Snowden says, help them understand that they're misunderstanding the fundamental nature of human rights. Nobody needs to justify why they need a right. The burden of justification falls on the one seeking to infringe upon the right. But even if they did, you can't give away the rights of others because they're not useful to you. More simply, the majority cannot vote away the natural rights of the minority. And finally, he said, but even if they could, help them think for a moment about what they're saying. And this was the phrase that got me. Arguing that you don't care about the right to privacy because you have nothing to hide is no different than saying you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. So I just that just hit me, because, you know, the point being that I may not be concerned about privacy, but I absolutely know the world is full of people who are, and I won't have access to their honest thoughts and feelings and truth. And I'm interested in that if they are muted because they don't feel they have the freedom to express themselves because they're worried about the world that they're in from a privacy standpoint. So I thought that was a really great point. And so I wanted to share that. And finally, before we take a break, I got I found it in the mailbag when I was doing the going through the Q&A stuff. David in Montreal, Quebec. He wondered whether I use SpinRite myself. He wrote, hi, Stephen Leo. I know that your backup strategy is very good, but have you had a situation where you had to use your own product for maintenance or to recuperate data for any reason? How many times over the years? And he says, thank you and keep up the good work. And I was put in mind of two things. The event which created SpinRite, like 25 years ago or however long it was, And then my most recent use. It was created when the hard drive at the company that my girlfriend owned, which was these are in the days when computers were PCs were $10,000, and the hard drive itself was $5,000, and it was 10 megabytes, and 3 years of accounting information that had never been backed up was inaccessible, and I had to get it back, yet it was inaccessible. So, you know, that experience, I succeeded. That experience was what started me on the path of turning the quick code that I wrote in order to perform the data recovery for her into a commercial product. And then I had mentioned it before. I'll remind David and our listeners that my most recent use was, you know, edge of my seat, because my own operations officer, Sue, I had set her up with a full RAID-based system, and with drive mirroring, so full redundancy. And the RAID began complaining when she booted her system with a critical failure of the RAID, because one drive had died. And then, unfortunately, under the critical message, it said, press escape to continue. And so she didn't want to bother me, so she tried pressing escape. And oh, what do you know? That computer booted. So that's what she kept doing. Every time she needed to boot, she'd get the critical error message. But, well, apparently it's not that critical.
Still works.
Yeah, boy. Until, of course, that fated morning when that drive died. And I got email from Sue saying, my computer has crashed. I can't get in and so forth. So it's like, oh, no. So I thought, okay, wait a minute. How could this happen? Because she's got a mirror. And we would know. We'd have lots of notice. Well, yeah, like a year's worth of notice, as it turns out.
Exactly.
But if you ignore the notice, or if you don't understand what it means. So I went down. And she said, oh, this will come up and say critical error, but if you just hit escape, it normally goes past it.
Oh, my God.
And I said, what? That's what. So I brought the computer home. I set it up, and I did what everyone who knows does. I became a SpinRite user. I mean, I didn't have to reach very far from my disk, and I booted SpinRite, and I let it run overnight, and in the morning, everything was fine. Now, yes, she was all backed up. She was in the cloud. We have nightly backups of the accounting system and so forth. But as everyone knows, you still have to rebuild the system and then reconstitute it and then restore it and all that. It's just – and then you've got the changes that occurred since that backup. So it's just better if you can get the disk recovered. And so – phew, I did. And we all learned a lesson. Sue now knows that how close we came, we were right on the edge. You know, it complained for a year. And I really learned, too, RAIDs that are in front of consumers, they need to stop working when the first drive dies. Even though, you know, it's the IT people that you know, cross themselves and say thank you for, you know, there being redundant drives. We know what to do now. But the consumer, when the first drive gives up, that's when it needs to say, okay, you can't, sorry, no computer today. Call your computer person, and then, you know, they'll know what to do. So, David, that's the story. Yes, indeed, it is my go-to tool.
True story.
When it hits the fan.
Let's take a break. We got questions for you. Steve's got answers. We're going to answer those in just a bit. But first, a question. How do you know who rang your doorbell last 10 minutes? Well, if you're at work, you don't know. You don't even know that somebody rang your doorbell. But I know who rang my doorbell.
And all of your listeners know, too, Leon.
Yes. It was thanks to my Ring. In fact, that sometimes happens. It'll ring during shows. And people go, oh, Leo's doorbell is ringing. It's my Ring video doorbell. Oh, it's just the cleaning ladies. No big deal. But what if it had been a bad guy? See, that's the beauty of the Ring video doorbell. You not only have a picture, you have audio, you can even speak to people who are at your door. And that's great when the delivery guy shows up, you could say, oh, just leave it, I'm in the bathtub. Or when somebody who's pretending to be a delivery guy, see, it turns out 95% of home robberies occur during the day while you're at work, and just to be sure, the bad guy comes and rings the front doorbell. If you're home, he goes, oh, sorry, wrong number. But if you're not, he goes around back and breaks in. The Ring video doorbell means you're always at home because wherever you are, you hear the doorbell ring. You can answer the doorbell. You can see who is there. And there's even a motion detector on it. This thing is so cool. And I installed this myself, so I'm not Mr. Handyman. But, boy, it comes with everything you need. Here's the Ring video doorbell kit. You get a screwdriver. You get a drill bit if you need one. You've got a level in here. USB cord, I'll tell you what that's for. And, of course, the doorbell itself. All I did was unscrew my old doorbell. I have a wired doorbell, so there were two wires coming out of the door jamb. And this was the easiest thing in the world. You mount this. It has a little mounting bracket. You put that on there first. You have the wires come out. You connect them to the terminals. And then you snap the Ring video doorbell on top of that. Now, notice it has a USB port on there. That's because there's also a lithium-ion battery in here, good for a year. So if you don't have a wired doorbell, you could still add a doorbell. They have another unit that you can put in your house that has chimes on it. It'll do it wirelessly. But I don't even need chimes anymore because I've put the Ring software on all of my stuff in the house. So when somebody's at the door, boy, do I know it, no matter where I am, even when I'm not home. And I love that. It also has a motion detector, so you can hear when somebody's going by out front. And it's completely configurable. So when I use my Ring, I can say how – I'll show you. In fact, I'll set it up here. I could say how much room outside – I should keep track of what the zones are. Notice they have lots of videos to walk you through this. So I've set it kind of mildly. You could set it so it checks like all the way out here if you want. If you do that, that's fine if you live in the country. If you live on a street, I'd move that zone in a little bit. But see, this is great. Even if somebody just kind of comes up and peers in the window, I'm going to see their video there. In fact, I'll show you. I can see motion as people come and go. This is really handy if you've got teenagers, because I know when my daughter came home, Abby, you came home at 2 a.m. What was that? What's that all about? It's great video, too. This is high def. Now, it's a very wide angle. It's almost a fisheye, so you can see everybody there. Oh, that looks like the food delivery guy from last night bringing dinner. And you hear the audio, and there's Lisa paying the guy. It is so awesome, I have to say. Now, here's the deal. We know you want your Ring right away, so we've arranged for free FedEx shipping right now if you go to ring.com/securitynow. It'll come in a couple of days. You'll install it in minutes, and you're going to love it. Time magazine named it one of the top 10 gadgets of 2014, and I think rightly so. It's just awesome. And, yeah, you can – you know what? Your spouse will be impressed that you installed this. Wow, you're quite the handyman. Yes, it was tough. But I figured it out. iOS, Android, high-def video, audio, and you can even talk back. It's the Ring video doorbell, and I love it. Ring.com/securitynow. Get free FedEx shipping right now when you go to ring.com/securitynow. We're big fans of the Ring video doorbell. All right, Steve Areno, time for Q&A. This has been a jam-packed episode, hasn't it? Holy camoly.
Everybody's getting their money's worth today.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. You're getting your money's worth.
That's right.
You get your money's worth if we just show up, you're getting your money's worth. Since you charge nothing. Let's see. Today.
That's right. They can get a refund if they're not happy.
Yeah, we'll give you every penny you paid comes back to you. Let me go full screen. This is question one from David in Washington State. Maybe he's from Walla Walla. I don't know. He writes that a friend of a friend may be a reason to opt out of Wi-Fi Sense. In episode 257, you stated that renaming your Wi-Fi SSID to include _ opt out is primarily useful for owners of public hotspots. That was my guess. It wasn't based on anything I knew. He said, that's certainly true, but if you manually share your Wi-Fi with a Windows 10 using Friend, they could choose to auto-share your network's login with all of their friends, which may not be what you'd prefer. So, in this Windows 10 world, if you ever give your network password to anyone using Windows 10, adding underscore opt-out to the SSID is probably a good idea. But as you point out, it's not as bad as everyone initially feared. And but just so you know, that's the value of it. I didn't even think of that.
Yep, I thought that was a good point, is that, you know, Windows 10 has no way of knowing when your friend enters your password that it's not a system that belongs to the household. Right. And, you know, and so, again, they would have to manually share it, but nothing prevents them from doing that. Or they may not understand that they don't have to turn that on. Who knows? So, you know, if they had enabled sharing on their, for example, their Windows 10 laptop, and for whatever reason you got onto your network and then chose to share it, then it would extend out into their friend field unless the SSID had opt-out in it. So, I think if probably in the future. I mean, it's a shame that it's not opt-in. That would be nice. Then if you wanted to have your network automatically shared, you add opt-in to the name. Otherwise, it defaults to opt-out. Unfortunately, I mean, I think that's the right way to do it. But that doesn't make it all just sort of magical and automatic and, oh, look, I'm already on your network. And you didn't even have to tell me. It's because we're Facebook friends. Oh, isn't that wonderful? Anyway,
Yeah, you can also opt out by not turning it on in the first place. But and it asks you every time. But, yeah, okay. That I have to check the thing a friend of a friend shares it. Is that true? That doesn't sound... That isn't right. That just because you shared it with a friend that they can share it with somebody else. That doesn't sound like a good thing to do.
And that's my point, is that the Windows 10 has no way of knowing. It's not your laptop.
Yeah. Dale Furai in Grand Haven wonders about the filter bubble. In light of the recent focus on tracking our browser usage, could you and Leo say a few words about how this affects the search results we get when using Google? If you've read The Filter Bubble, that's Eli Pariser's book about this, what views does it put forward, and do you agree? Do you know The Filter Bubble?
I do, and you referred to this phenomenon on some other podcast.
This Week in Google. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And I thought this was a good. We've never discussed it on the podcast, but it is an interesting phenomenon. And that was the observation that in Google's trying to provide you with, first of all, Google learning who you are, looking at your past history of searches, and you know, essentially working to they say the best job they can. When I search for something and you search for something and Dale searches for something, we actually get different search results because Google filters this through what it knows about us in order to try to select what we want. And so, for example, to take a simple black and white case, politics, where you've got Republicans and Democrats, you know, left and right. You might do a search, and Google has algorithmically determined that, you know, your party affiliation without knowing it, but just sort of by understanding that, you know, other people who have searched for things you've searched for have also searched for these things, so we're going to give you the same sort of results. Well, as a consequence, you end up with sort of a skewed view to the degree that Google is the internet. And we've laughed about that and chuckled about it even last week, that, you know, many people don't realize Google is not the internet because it's the way they have any visibility, but that it actually does... It does skew individuals' views into the internet.
Yeah, I mean, you can always, use the incognito mode if you want, but then you wouldn't have your login there. Rick in Colorado,
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, So Dale, I do agree that it is an interesting and it may be important thing to keep in mind that, as you say, Leo, somebody who very much wanted to get unbiased results just, you know, needs not to be known by Google. And are you sure that incognito, I know that it doesn't record what you do, but does it?
It says if you're not logged in.
Okay, good.
This only works if you're logged in, obviously, because it can't collect signals if you're not. And I'm not convinced the filter bubble is as dramatic.
Is it big deal?
Say. Yeah. I know Jeff Jarvis thinks it's not, but you know, I'm not convinced. If you search, you could still search for anything you want. What it's trying to do is give you. I mean, what Google wants to do is give you the best results for your interests. Give you the top results for what you're searching for. And if it can add signals from other sources, including your own previous searches, it's going to do that. But I'm not sure that it really conditions the searches as badly as people might say. You still see other stuff. Rick in Colorado feels that the iPhone fingerprint unlock is worthless. Someone can force you physically to apply your fingerprint to various sensors. iPhones can get around this by turning off your phone. After which you must enter your passphrase. Oh, he probably means iPhone users. If you turn off your phone, you have to enter your passphrase before you can use it, the fingerprint again. But why doesn't Apple offer a fast lock for their products? I would recommend that a different fingerprint be used as a method of instantly locking the phone so that it once again requires the entry of the passphrase. You agree?
So, well, this is an opportunity to talk about a couple features that people may not be aware of. First of all, the way the legislation stands at the moment, you can be compelled to relinquish a fingerprint.
It ain't legislation. It's called the Constitution. Problem. Courts have held that the Constitution says just as you can be asked for a fingerprint or your DNA, you can be asked to unlock a phone with your fingerprint.
Correct. However, the recent legislation has held that a user cannot be forced to divulge a passphrase. So passwords, something that we know is protected. Something that we are is not protected. So that's the first thing, I mean, to note. But the features that people may not be aware of is that there is granularity in the settings for the iPhone fingerprint. You can specifically disable its unlocking, yet leave its other utility in place. So if you go into control panel and touch ID and something, I think it's lock screen or whatever that's called, there you'll find settings. And there are three switches. Normally they're all on. The first one is unlock the phone. So you are able to turn that off if this was a concern of yours, then still use it to authenticate your identity to applications and iCloud and so forth while you're using the phone after it's already been unlocked, but your fingerprint won't take it out of the out of the locked state. And you know, and we've talked about this, the fact that Apple requires an unlock, a passcode unlock coming in from a reboot or power off. And so, for example, if you were using your phone normally, the thing to do if like you're crossing the border or you're entering some situation where it might be necessary or you might be subjected to forced unlocking, do just power down your phone. Sort of keep that in mind. And I will finally say that I use the full Alpha keyboard. We know that with iOS 9, they went to a 6-digit passcode, but still better to use the keyboard. For me, the whole keyboard comes up, and I don't have a big, fancy, impossible to type on a horrible touch keyboard, but just because there are so many more buttons there, I type a few things and my phone is up and running. The point being that the iPhone is very good about counting those guesses and shutting itself down if somebody guesses wrong. And so using the full ASCII keyboard and something that is, you know, it doesn't have to be super long and difficult, because it just means that it's going to be far more difficult for someone to guess.
It's the Fifth Amendment. You're right against self-incrimination.
Ah,
so,
right.
So courts and the Supreme Court even have ruled that you can be compelled to give up physical evidence, like your fingerprint. If you're arrested, you can't say, no, I'm not giving you my fingerprint. But stuff that's in your head.
Right.
That's equivalent of testifying against yourself.
And, yes.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes.
Amazingly.
Odd, but I'm glad to know. Our listeners who are really concerned just need to, you know, understand that no one can make them give up a password. They can just say
right.
no.
Right. Just say no. Or plead the fifth. Connor in Castlegar, British Columbia asks. I don't know what happened with the accent there. Steve, it's the Castlegar. That sounds like it's in Scotland.
Mix it up.
Steve, I'm running Windows 7 Pro and considering upgrading to Windows 10 Pro, but is there any privacy difference between paying for a new license or getting the free upgrade? Regards, Connor.
No. I thought that was an interesting question. You know, the idea being that, well, you know, is the freeness of Windows 10's upgrade a trade-off that you're making in divulging all this, you know, the advertising ID and everything? And so if I were to pay for it, could I not have that? Nope. And so the answer is nope. That's Windows 10.
There is one difference between the paid and the free upgrade. The free upgrade, you agree to accept updates. You can defer them, but you can't prevent them. If you take the free upgrade to Windows 10, you are then bound to accept all Windows updates from then on. You could put it off.
So it might shut off or shut down or like.
Well,
say,
I think
hey,
the I think that I don't, yes, it might. I think you'd have a cause for upset if that happened. But I think the real intent from Microsoft is that they want to really get people to do automatic updates.
Yeah.
And one way to do that is to say, look, you got to accept automatic updates if you're going to accept the free upgrade. That's just the deal. But if you pay for it, you don't have to.
Hmm.
And I don't know, you know, that's because some businesses don't want to do that. But the free upgrade is only for consumers. Businesses still have to buy it.
And I wonder, I didn't even look. I wonder if the free upgrade lets you turn them off. They might have just taken the switch away.
Yeah, you can't. you can defer it. You could say, put it off. I don't want to do it this week. Let's do it next week.
Okay.
But you can't put it off forever. And actually, I don't know what happens if you put it off forever. I think at some point they spank you. I have to ask Steve, Paul Thurrott about that.
Paul, yeah.
Kevin Schwartz, Kansas City, Missouri, had a website security question. Steve and Leo, I've been a dedicated listener to Security Now since episode one. Thank you both for keeping us up to date on what's happening out there. I want to share something with you and your listeners with regard to security questions on websites. I'm talking about those questions you provide answers to in case of a forgotten username or password. Leo's often said he never answers these questions truthfully because the correct answers might be available somewhere online or even known by someone you know. Lately, I've been using LastPass to generate 30-character passwords for these answers. Good thinking. I put the questions and passwords into a secure note inside of LastPass for safekeeping and easy lookup. There are times when I've had to remove the option of including special characters because they aren't accepted, but with the 30 characters I use, I feel safe. Frankly, any random data be fine.
Yeah.
Or even data you could remember, but just is wrong. I suppose you could go even longer than 30, but that's what I choose. I don't think anybody brute forces security questions. Maybe they do. I don't know. I know this might be a pain if you have to answer those questions, but it really does happen very often. I got a story for you, Steve.
Oh, good.
So I was trying some password
alternatives.
Vaults. The number two password vaults used by, I think, 13 million people is Keeper. And I was somewhat taken aback when it said, oh, and now here's your security question. Because normally, good company like LastPass says, don't forget your password. We can't recover it.
Right.
Keeper says, oh, just tell me. And so that one security question, and I can recover my password.
Ooh.
Now, that raised two problems for me. One is the security question in general. But two, doesn't that mean they have access to my password?
Yeah. I mean, there could be something in Keeper which uses your answer to the question to decrypt the password.
Okay. So you'd need to know the answer.
Right. You'd have to have the exact answer. Then it could decrypt using that answer as the key to its encryption. So I could see how it could be done right, and let's hope that that's what they did.
But it's inherently done wrong, and there shouldn't be a security question, period. That's a huge security hole, right?
Yes.
Because most people are going to use, you know, mother's maiden name, and boom, that's the password to your master vault now.
Yeah, and the problem is it's always struck me as being a soft answer. That is, wait, did I spell my teacher's name with a capital letter or not? Did I put his full name? Because I remember his first name. Did I say Mr. Farron or Harold Farron? He was my electronics teacher in high school. I don't know. It just, I've never been really comfortable with those. The kick I got out of this question that Kevin asks is he's using LastPass, which prevents him from ever needing to remember his password.
Right. Occasionally, the banks will use secret questions, even if you knew the password.
Oh, that's true. They'll just say, you know, we're tired of accepting your password on blind faith, so prove us that you still remember your mother's maiden name. Mm-hmm. And Lord help you if that's the question that you chose.
As somebody's pointing out, LastPass has a time-limited password recovery. When you create a new password, you have 90 days if you forget it. But the way they do that is you have to know the old password. So clearly they used the old password to encrypt the new password.
It's called a bootstrap.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're able to bootstrap yourself. And again, every step of the way, everything Joe has designed, he's like, he's clearly spent some time.
Very thoughtful.
And then what is the least we exposure that we can have, which is exactly what we want, yet we can offer the service to our customers. And clearly, as LastPass exploded in popularity, people who are not super savvy, you know, like Jenny, is using it. She might mistype her new password or forget what she changed it to, but still know her old one. And so Joe's like, okay, wait a minute. We do not want this information, but what's the perfect trade-off? And the perfect trade-off is a forgiveness period where until it expires, we'll forgive you if you forget the change you made. But otherwise, after that point, you've proven you have the new one, so now we're going to forget the old one. I mean, that's brilliant.
Right.
It's exactly what you want.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's why I continue to be, you know, encouraged that, you know, that they're going to, you know, that they're the right choice. Let's hope it remains so.
Jim in Chicago comes to us with question numero 60. Jim, that's no language. There's no language that says that. Jim in Chicago, Illinois, wonders about ad blocking at the network level. Steve, you and Leo have done a great job covering ad blocking in iOS from every possible angle. Hey. However, those ad blockers only work on an iPhone or iPad. Is there a way to block ads across an entire network? I have an ASUS AC3200 router, same as Leo, I believe. Yes. Love that router. And I've looked for ways to block ads at the router level, but I haven't figured out how. So how?
Okay, so first of all, it's probably not going to work for long. As we predicted, the first response to the increase of use of ad blocking will be that sites will detect it, and as we know, there's already a publicly a privately financed, but a venture financed company that is offering this as a service. So it's even been subbed out so that a site can say, okay, we want a service to detect ad blocking and notify people who visit our site that, you know, like either blank the site or beg them or, you know, whatever. There's a range of things they can do. So the point is, I don't think it will be feasible to operate without the ability to whitelist. And a network-wide facility is going to make whitelisting more difficult. But the way it's done is with DNS. The idea being that all of the devices in your network rely probably on the DNS that they receive from your router. Routers certainly do provide the DNS IP. They may provide their own IP, in which case everything in the network asks the router for the IP address of a given domain. Then the router turns around and asks the DNS servers that it's been configured with, and then so it's a proxy for the network's DNS, and then it returns the answer to the requester. Or a little bit sort of older school is that the router will simply pass on the DNS IP addresses that it's received from upstream, or that it may have been overridden with. You may, for example, want to use Level 3's DNS or Google's or OpenDNS or some other DNS, so you can tell your router, offer the following DNS or use the following DNS for your queries. The point is, that's the way to do it. There are, you know, the way these ad blockers work, these lists of ad blockers or lists that the ad blockers use are just domain names. You know, doubleclick.net is like, you just, all you have to do is say that that's a bad domain name, and everything in your network will fail to look up the IP of doubleclick.net and won't be able to retrieve any ads. If you want to pursue this, though, there is a very nice solution based on a Raspberry Pi. It sort of combines the name Raspberry Pi and the notion of a black hole, because essentially you are, and this is the networking term, you're black holing those domain names. You're telling this set of domain names, go nowhere. We don't want lookups to those domain names to succeed. They are black holed. So the project is called Pi Hole.
As in shut your.
As in, yes.
Shut your pie hole.
pi-hole.net. And this is a nice little project. You know, you spend, what, $20 or $30 for a Raspberry Pi. You use this software. It turns it into an advertising-aware DNS server so that it sits on your network, and it provides, it fields all of the DNS requests within your network, and it is then, it is updated in the same way that our ad blockers are updated in the background with any new additions or removals from the list. So it's a nice, simple way of performing network-wide ad blocking. And for, you know, $20 or $30, the cost of a Raspberry Pi provides Jim what he wants. So it was cool, and I thought that would appeal to a subset of our listeners, so I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of piehole.net.
So really, somebody, some enterprising person, could set up a DNS server that does the same thing, and all you'd have to do is change your router to point to that. I wonder why no one's done that.
Actually, they exist. You can also Google DNS ad blocking, and you'll find all kinds of projects like that.
Yeah, I mean, I just need a number. OpenDNS could do it, for instance.
Steve, they're unlikely to, of course, because they're too high profile.
Yeah,
but some sort of off the beaten path. You know, somebody who's got a real thing. The problem is, I expect it's going to be infeasible, and that's why I led with that. Is you'll hit a site that refuses to let you proceed, and now you're stuck. Because you don't have the ability to whitelist, because somewhere else in your network, the DNS server is refusing to give you the IP for that site. So I wanted to let everybody know it exists as an option, but I unfortunately think that local blocking and that allows local whitelisting is probably going to be the solution.
Yeah. Steve Bourgeois in Paris. I wonder if that's really his name. wonders about web encryption strength. Hello, Steve. I've been trying to find an alternative to LastPass after the latest announcement. So I checked the two next in line, which are supposed to use the same process, Dashlane and 1Password. They both advertise an AES 256-bit encryption process. But when checking the Dashlane website certificate, it was AES 128. Support replied, AES 128 is just the way our website's encrypted before being transmitted and displayed in the user's browser. AES 128 has nothing to do with the data of our users, which is encrypted using AES 256. But when I upload updated data via my browser to my vault on their site, isn't the data transmitted at AES 128? Could you please explain? Sorry for my noobness in this matter. I like to listen to your show, even if I'm lost some of the time. Steve from Paris. Yes, I am French, and I am called Steve.
Or Esteban, I think, probably.
No, that's Spanish.
Oh, that's right. That was my Spanish name. I don't think I ever knew what my French
Esteban.
Name was. Esteban. Like anyway, there's a couple things here. I'm sort of trying to decide which to do first. First of all, 128 bits is what pretty much everybody is using now. The various encryption systems, LastPass, Dashlane, 1Password, whatever, are using 256 just because they can. There is no 128-bit AES. Is there? I don't think so. I think there's no 256, 384, and 512 are the three different key lengths. But a 128-bit key is still just fine. It's what the web is using. If you go to Google, of all people, https://, Google is now HTTPS. Just bring up the Google page and then look at the certificate details. You will see AES 128 is the cipher that they used, meaning a 128-bit key. So from a practical standpoint, to address that aspect first, 128 bits is nobody is worried about that today. It is absolutely fine. We're hoping to be with AES for a long time. So that's why 128-bit keys were not part of that competition. We went 256, 384, and 512, which will last us, we will know about aliens by the time AES 512 is a problem, because even though, the key lengths are only doubling, that is, the point I've tried to make is, every bit you add doubles the difficulty. So we've added to go from AES 128 to 256 is, wait a minute, AES 128. Is there a 128-bit AES?
He's probably just confusing SSL.
Might be.
That's where he gets the 128. There's an AES 128.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's been a while since I've looked at the protocol.
Yeah,
so
AES 128, 192, and 256.
Okay, those are the three. So I was up by a factor of two. So yes, 256 is there because we can't. So that's AES 128 that nobody is worried about. That's what our all of our internet use is often being encrypted by, if that's what the client and server agree to. 256 is there. I was confusing it with hash lengths because there are longer hashes. 256 is there because it was part of the spec. And so in creating these systems, LastPass, Dashlane, 1Password, they're like, well, more is better. More is going to make our users feel better. So let's make them feel better. Let's use 256. Absolutely no benefit. today, because as I was saying, if you make the cipher stronger than it absolutely needs to be, you're just, you know, spending time computing. But there's no reason not to. So first off, AES 128, just fine. That's what the web is using. But the tech support guy who talked to you, Steve, did say it correctly. That is, assuming that those other products work the way LastPass does, and I'm not vouching for them. I haven't looked at them. I don't know them. I know LastPass. LastPass absolutely pre-encrypts the data that they're sending. So you would never want it to be over an unencrypted connection, because that would also be unauthenticated. And we absolutely care about the authentication to make sure that we are talking to LastPass's servers, even though this blob is encrypted. So the blob of our vault is encrypted in all these cases with 256-bit encryption, even though that's way more than necessary. Then it is sent over a 128-bit encrypted channel, which, again, is plenty. We're pre-encrypting it, not because we're worried about it in transit, but because we never want to give it to the other end in a non-encrypted form. That's why we encrypt it before we send it. So it actually is the case that the channel's security matters much less, but 128 bits is just fine.
Don't worry, in other words.
Yeah, and I was thinking about SHA because for example, Squirrel uses SHA 256 and 512 at various points. So so that's what I was confused between that and AES.
Yeah. Paul in London, Ontario, Canada, wonders about dynamic DNS providers. Steve, great show. I listen to you and Leo every week without fail. Great podcast. But looking into dynamic DNS providers. And was wondering if they're more secure than my ISP DNS, and if it's a good idea to use one. I have a Netgear Nighthawk R7000 router, and they have partnered with No IP to provide this service. Are there any advantages or issues with doing this? Thanks, Paul.
So, Paul, these are sort of two different things. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to explain. What dynamic DNS is used for is for any situation where the endpoint may not have a fixed IP. So, for example, all of us, and I'm including myself now, having lost my two T1s, I'm now a cable modem user. My IP never changes unless... Like I disconnect my router from the net for a long time, or, you know, typically it just doesn't change. It's largely static, but it was an IP that the DHCP client in the router received dynamically from the ISP. So it can change, and it has changed since I began using the cable modem, for example. It's changed a couple times, but only as a result of major upheavals of things. So the idea is your home has an IP, but it might change. And say that you had an OpenDNS server running on and deliberately exposed publicly, so that when you were traveling, you could use OpenDNS to create OpenVPN. You had an OpenVPN server running on your home network, and so that you could use OpenVPN to log into your OpenVPN server at home to access your internal network. I actually have a setup like that. So it's one that's very convenient. The problem is, what if you were away and the lease expired on your router's public IP, and as could happen, for whatever reason, it obtained a different IP? Normally the lease expires and it says to the ISP server, hey, I used to have this IP, my lease has expired, what's the story? If the ISP had some reason to move your IP, they could. Normally, they just reissue the same IP just for sort of for the sake of letting everything stay the same. But there's no guarantee. So if you were away from home and your lease expired, your home's IP that was available, you know, to the public would change. And you wouldn't know what it was. You would not be able to log in to your network. So that's the problem that Dynamic DNS solves. And that's why it's in your router. Is your router partnering with the no IP service means that your router will inform no IP if its IP changes. And no IP is a DNS server and service where you can create an account with them and say, you know, paulinlondon.noip.com. That would be a sort of a pseudo domain name. And I mean, it's a real domain name, but it's sort of like a machine underneath, you know, the noip.com. So paulinlondon.noip.com would resolve to your router's IP even if that IP changed. So what this whole thing is it's a means for anyone who needs remote access to a network whose IP may change to have that change tracked by a service that they're able to ask essentially, what is my current IP? And this system makes that happen. So this is not at all the same as your ISP's DNS, which is why, you know, the question of is it as secure as your ISP's DNS? It's just an entirely different thing. Your ISP provides, you know, lookup for all IPs that are on the internet based on name. This is a facility that allows your IP to sort of be mapped into a domain name that you would use in order to always be able to find your network. And most of the high-end router firmware allows dynamic DNS support. You know, basically you give the router the information, your account information, and it's able to update that public provider with any IP changes that it experiences. Very cool.
And I suppose in these days of limited IP addresses, you probably can't count on having a static IP address. It must probably cost a lot. I haven't looked, but I can only imagine.
Yeah, I think, for example, Cox will, you know, for example, the business services version will give you a static IP, and you just pay more for it.
Right.
So if you absolutely needed one, you could buy it. At this point, I have no need for it, right. So I'm just not worrying right. about it.
But, and you know but what? My experience has been, and a couple of people are talking about this in the chat room, it's rare that your IP address changes.
Yes, it really is.
The right to do it, but I don't think they ever do. Or maybe
for example,
it's just a way of getting you to pay.
I changed cable modems and routers at the same time, because now, you know, I'm using a pfSense-based FreeBSD router. In that change, my IP did change. So I was off the net, needing to pair with a new cable modem. And I think it was the new cable modem, in fact, that Cox sort of thought, oh, whoa, what? Okay. And just, you know, gave me a new IP when I came back up. But since then, absolutely rock solid. It is there. I can't really, unless they were, for example, say that they needed to migrate their huge block of users off of a certain chunk of IP space over to somewhere else for some network architecture They would have the ability, knowing that leases are going to expire, typically it's a 24-hour lease that you receive. They would know that they could force the migration. It would upset some things that were sensitive to it, but generally not.
Are you ready? Because Ben Shipley in Atlanta, Georgia, wants to get quite techie. I've been a continuous listener since 2011. I am an undergraduate student in the Atlanta area. In my hardware software concepts class, my professor has asked the class to figure out, oh, he's going to have you do his homework.
He is.
Why a VPN software application would use UDP for communication between a PC and the VPN concentrator. I have found no mention of this in our class textbook, Irv Englander's The Architecture of Computer Hardware Systems Software and Networking, an Information Technology Approach. So I figured I'd consult the legend himself. See, he throws in that little, you're a legend, Steve, surely.
Right.
And then he says, Steve, do you know? Of course, Steve knows.
It just so happens.
I think that it's not in the book. It's a exercise in logic. You should be able to figure it out, right?
Well, you would really have to pretty much have a grip on how networking works. It's something that we've talked about because it's an interesting fact. And that is that TCP, which is the normal communications protocol, which you would expect to use, it has what it guarantees is when you send packets in one end, they come out the other end with none lost and in the same order as they went in. So lost packets end up getting detected because the far end doesn't acknowledge their receipt. And so the sender always holds on to the packets it has sent until they've been acknowledged by the other end. So at that point, it's able to let go of them, but it holds on and it holds them, it buffers them until it gets that acknowledgement of the highest byte number of any packet the other end has received. So that's the guarantee that TC provides. UDP has none of that. UDP is we squirted off a packet and we don't know what happened to it. We're not worried about it. It's gone. So there, and here's the trick. This is going to get you an A in your class on your homework, Ben. Let's hope that your professor is not a subscriber and listener to Security Now, or you know you've been had. But what you're probably trying to do with a VPN is tunnel other TCP connections, like browser connections that are all TCP. And something really ugly happens if you tunnel TCP in TCP. That is, if you use a TCP connection to carry TCP protocol, because then you've got both TCPs trying to correct for problems. And you don't want that.
Mm-mm.
So a packet gets lost, and the carrying tunnel recognizes that it never got an acknowledgement for the packet. So it resends it. But the packet that was carrying was also sent by the TCP protocol that was going through that tunnel. So that is, the payload also got lost. So that TCP realizes it never got an acknowledgement, and so it resends it. So you've got the VPN resending and the client resending, and it could be a mess. In fact, it can create a complete collapse of the VPN. It can stall the tunnel, and that's one of the things that happens when people try to use a TCP tunnel to carry TCP data, which is mostly what people are carrying. What you want then for a VPN is you want the VPN to simulate the internet, and the internet doesn't care. If a packet gets lost, that's the way it was designed. Buffers got full on an interface, and it couldn't, it's too many coming in and not enough bandwidth going out. A router, as we have often discussed, is completely free by design to just drop the packets. It figures somebody is going to figure that out. If they care, they will send it again. So the bottom line is you want UDP protocol to be used for the VPN, because it, like the internet, doesn't care. And that way, the client protocols being carried by the tunnel, they can do the packet recovery, sending again, and then causing another UDP packet to be sent. Whereas the UDP protocol, you know, stuff happens on the internet.
You know, I think we did cover this.
Yeah.
I remember talking
it's
about this.
Really, it's a really, I love the concept. It's pure internet theory. Really neat.
Which means that the professor listens to this show.
Oh, that's where he got it.
And that's where he got it. Bet you anything. Last question comes from Kelly Ship in Conway, Arkansas. Kelly wonders, how do you search episodes? You should offer a way to search all the Security Now episodes by keyword or phrase. This way we could check to see whether you have discovered or reviewed something yet. It could keep you from getting repetitive topical emails, etc. Surely you have the episode text already database searchable. Thank you.
You know, I put this in here just to wrap up our Q&A because I get the question all the time. And if you go to the page that Leo always mentions at the end of the podcast, where all Security Now things happen, grc.com/SN, there is a search box and in the upper right. And it's not very big. It's not in your face, but it's there. It's on every page of the website. It's in the main menu for grc.com. And all of the, thanks to Elaine and her transcribing, she's busy right now. As I say in this, she's typing these words and these words and these words and these words.
That's me.
And they're all going into the transcript and being indexed by our favorite search engine, Google. And it knows about all of the podcasts and when they occurred. And I use it all the time myself. And you've often heard me say, oh, back in this episode. Well, I don't know. I don't have all this memorized. I put a few terms into the search box and it finds what episode we were talking about that in. So, yes, Kelly, just go to grc.com/SN for Security Now and search to your heart's content. And thank you for asking so that I could tell everybody else, because lots of people ask for that. And it's right there.
You can also do it right on Google if you just do site:grc.com and then whatever your topic. And as you say, Google does do a good job of indexing not just the transcripts but everything on your website. So I put in the word LastPass, and there's episode from 2010 in which we reviewed Security Now 2010. That's odd. That must be a typo or something. Anyway, in which we reviewed LastPass transcripts from episodes 256, 512, the PDF of your show notes, the download. You can pretty much get everything you need. Google's very good at that. That's a good Google tip. Site:, will constrain the research to a particular site.
It's funny, too. When I'm searching around for various topics, I'm now finding GRC coming up. Mm-hmm. I guess it's probably because Google knows me, come to think of it. Maybe it wouldn't happen for everybody. But there are obscure pages on GRC that I have not thought of for a long time, often branching off of the health tree. And I'll be searching for something, and it will find a PDF that has been indexed on GRC. It's like, what? Oh, yeah, I guess that is there. So, yeah, sometimes
it's very handy. Yeah. Google's everywhere. Well, that was fun.
That was, I think,
a new record.
Useful. we're about 2 hours and 5 minutes.
Oh, that's not so bad. All right.
We're getting out of here in time for your tech news tonight.
That's
so that,
right.
that timing works. And I'm glad we heard from Joe. I feel good about where we are. I'm glad he knows that the industry is really concerned.
Yeah.
And I think that'll help. Not that anyone is ever suggesting that he needs to be kept honest, but, you know, maybe it's log me in who wants to get some value for their $110 million. And you were right, by the way, Leo. It was $110 million and with a $15 million bonus that bumps it up to $125 if they meet some future goals. So log me in doesn't want to do anything to cause their investment to be worth less than
right.
You know, was negotiated. So they need to understand this is different than Hamachi. this is, you know,
yeah, don't screw with this.
This is competitive, and we're very skittish because it's all about trust. We trust Joe. We don't trust them.
Right.
And they've given us lots of reason not to. So don't screw with this. Log me in. Leave LastPass alone.
And that's
and
an
leave
important
Joe
message.
And his people.
It's
great that
everybody made such noise about this. And I hope they keep they will, because that really sends a signal to them. You want to get your money out of this company, you better do right by us.
Well, they will see a hit. There will be a notch. Yes, there will be a notch anyway, and so that's lesson number one. But you know, those of us who understand, who believe in Joe and LastPass and the technology, we're not going anywhere because there's no reason to today.
Yeah.
But let's hope for continued good behavior. Otherwise, believe me, I will find us an alternative.
Well, I keep looking because that's the other problem is. Who knows who these other guys are? Do you trust them? Do they have a track record? One Password's been around for a while, but you'd have to really look deeply, as you have already done with LastPass, to figure out everything that they're doing.
Yeah, and the problem is the things we love end up succeeding and then getting bought.
I think we're just going to whisper
the next one.
Yeah.
But for now, I'm staying warp. I'm staying put.
Hey, thank you so much, Steve. Steve's at grc.com. That's where you go to find LastPass. SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. You can also find his perfect password, his password generator, his perfect paper passwords. Password haystacks, off the grid.
Yep.
All sorts of free software, lots of information. And yes, this show, both audio and written transcripts, which are very handy if you like to read along. grc.com. We also have copies at Twit, of course. It's a Twit podcast at twit.tv/SN, audio and video as well. And you can get it the easiest thing is subscribe because it's all over the place. Anywhere you get your podcasts, you'll have Security Now. We do the show Tuesdays, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern time. That's 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can at twit.tv/live. All our shows, we stream live as we're producing them. That's about it. If you want to be here, email tickets at twit.tv. We have a limited room, but we got some very nice people from Washington and Chicago here, and they're big fans of yours, Steve, and they say hi.
Cool. Hi back.
What's the French word? His name's Steve, too. What's the French for Steve? You don't know either. Esteban. I'm sure we'll hear. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Thanks, Leo.
Security.